Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Library Coven, a bi-weekly podcast in which two bookish besties discuss mostly YA fantasy through the lens of intersectional feminist criticism. Why? Because talking about books is pretty magical.
I'm Jesse.
And I'm Kelly.
This week, we're discussing That Selfsame Metal by Brittany N. Williams, which follows 16-year-old Joan, who has powers granted to her by the Orisha god Ogun, which means that Joan can manipulate metal. When a pact with the Fae isn't renewed, the Fae wreak havoc on Shakespearean London, and it turns out that some of the Fae from Midsummer's Night's Dream are based on real Fae. Chaos ensues as Joan tries to kill Oberon. As it does.
As it does. Excellent summary.
Thank you.
Initial reactions. Will you start us off?
I will. So 5 out of 5 stars for me. I listened to the audiobook, which was narrated by Patricia Williams. I'm assuming no relation. And I loved it. The setting was one that I don't see a lot in YA. And I really like the mixing of the Orisha and the Fae in one story. I think that's something that I haven't encountered. Not saying it doesn't exist, but it was just nice to see something a little bit different. What did you think?
I loved this book. I agree with you that the space-time was not one that we have seen often in YA, and the why can't multiple magical systems exist at once, multiple spiritual systems exist at once in any point in history ever, right? I thought the magic was really cool. I thought the character building was fun. I enjoyed the cast of characters. There were enough of them that it made it interesting, but not so many that you're who are you? Who is this person? Why do I care? I love this book. This will be definitely a recommend to other people for me. I thought this was really well done.
Yeah, agreed.
Recommend if you like. This one, there was, for me, a lot was coming to mind. I was definitely Legendborn and Bloodmarked by Tracy Dion. Folk of the Air series by Holly Black for Fae and court machinations and stuff. And I would also say if you're into Shakespearean things, this would maybe be a fun different retcon culture jam version.
Yeah. I say Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi. I'm sure that she was not the first one to do this, but it was the first book that I read where I encountered the Orisha. I would say Shakespeare in Love, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie. It's so, so good. Would recommend if you haven't seen it before, but so much from that movie comes up again in this story. And I feel like if you've seen that movie, then you feel like I knew who Shakespeare was, obviously, from Western school. Shakespeare is just always going to be part of that. Well, maybe not always, but it was for me. But Burbage was in there, women not being allowed to, be in plays, and then one being in a play anyway. So I would recommend that movie if you haven't seen it. It is rated R because there's sex in it. So if that's not your jam, then you're forewarned. But yeah, it's really good. Love it a lot. Would recommend.
Great. Why did we choose this book?
I think Kelly picked this one probably because it sounded super amazing and they were super right. So yeah, I think you picked this.
I don't remember that, but I'm glad that you're giving me credit. Yes, I'll run with it. That's great.
Time to talk world building in Through the Wardrobe.
Could have put this in Kill Your Darlings, but I thought it was more of a world building tactic. The interludes with the different POVs, I thought that those were super quick and effective, a way to expand the reader's viewpoint without being this is a character that you're now going to have to track for the next 17 hours or 300 pages or however long it was. I thought that this was an excellent choice on the author's part. And then you got to build some suspense and create the sense of dramatic irony because the reader knows what's going on, but these, characters in the story don't. What did you think about this part?
Yeah, I thought it was really well done also. I think one of my complaints sometimes about the Crescent City books, for example, is it follows so many characters and when you're reading those, I'm I don't understand why this person is important. Can we get back to the main characters? But I feel like in this book, I was like, none of those interludes was I like, oh, I don't understand why we're here. Like, get back to Joan. Even though I was really invested in Joan's story, I was like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder how this is going to interplay with what's going on with Joan and her brother and everything that's going on with them. So I think this was really well done and like didn't feel unnecessary, which I think can be really hard to pull off.
Yeah, for sure. We are in Shakespearean / Elizabethan England, as you mentioned at the top. So that definitely, like, whatever image the reader has in their head of that place, like, they're going to be bringing that to the book, which I thought was, you know, smart of the author to be, like, building off of this, like, historical moment that kind of is like a lore. It's like a fantastical place in and of itself, right? Because of the vision that we have of it, which is like probably not actually true to history. But I thought we have like a little plague moment in there, a little moral panic / panic around that. And yeah, just a lot of the court stuff that I think we'll talk about a little bit later. But yeah, I thought that the world building was really well done.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Another, like, I guess this kind of goes and recommend if you like. And when I was writing the notes, I was like, there was one more, but I couldn't remember what it was. Like, A Knight's Tale. I feel like that's, like, a good one. Like, I also really like, I know people will hate this, but I like the Romeo and Juliet by, like, what's that guy's name? Baz Luhrmann. I know people hate it. That's totally fine. I love it. I've loved it for, like, ever. I don't know if it's a recommend if you like, but also, like, I like it when we see Shakespeare taken out of its time and place, which maybe we should talk about later. But yeah, I really liked all these like little Easter eggs almost from history, and some that maybe like teen readers might not be as familiar with, but kind of like put you in that headspace and is like, I feel like this would be like a good read along like in a high school English class if you're reading Shakespeare, but also read this like other take on Shakespeare that's like more modern story. That even though it takes place in the same time as Shakespeare, but I feel like it can like go along with it really well, especially if they're doing Midsummer Night's Dream, like that would be perfect.
I love that idea. Genius. If you're a high school teacher out there, please use this, because yeah, there's so much that you could talk about, because I mean, we'll talk about it in One Does Not Simply, but like so many racial elements, you know, that also show up in Shakespeare's plays, but that people probably like gloss over depending on which demographic you're in and where you're getting taught this stuff, right? But you were talking about like historical people. And on that note, there's like a Guy Fawkes cameo, which is kind of fun, like the referencing the gunpowder plot and the 5th of November, which like I only know about that from V for Vendetta. That's like how I know about the Guy Fawkes, because it's like not we don't have bonfire night in the U.S., you know. So, yeah, that this is one of those things that maybe teen readers aren't familiar with, but then you would become familiar with this. And I think that there's an author's note that describes things, if I remember correctly. So,
yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like we've kind of mentioned, we get a lot of real people from history in this story. This story takes place after the death of Queen Elizabeth I, which was interesting because I think we always think, like, I guess it's Elizabethan England still, but we always think of Queen Elizabeth being around at this time. So England is under the reign of King James, of the King James Bible. And we have Shakespeare and his company putting on plays, which I just thought was super fun. I liked this like behind the scenes view of like theater and acting and that sort of thing was cool.
Yeah. From like a little bit of graduate studies. Yeah. I remember that like there were a lot of theater troupes at this time. Like it was like kind of that were patronized by all these different courts. So like if you're in Spain, you're also having, you know, theater at this time. And that's like a court players. Although it's interesting because women could perform in Spanish plays. There were like actors that are women at the time, but in England, because white people are so fucking repressed.
Yeah, but also so weird because like they had like Queen Elizabeth was like an unmarried woman in charge, and they're still like, no, women can't do this other thing, but you're gonna let her lead a country? Like that doesn't make any sense to me. But
she wasn't like a # intersectional feminist.
No, I guess it's like internalized misogyny or something, but I was just like, that makes no sense. Whatever.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's discuss all things magic. We get like the syncretism of magical systems from like Celtic folklore with the Fae and stuff like that, and also Orisha traditions from Western Africa, if I'm getting my geography correct.
I think so.
And yeah, I thought this mixed like so well. It was like so beautifully done. yeah, like no notes, like I'm just like in awe, just like bowing down. So good.
Yeah, and I feel like we get a lot of backstory about the Orisha, like in Children in Blood and Bone, but it wasn't really necessary in this story. But you still like, they felt familiar. And maybe that's because, maybe because we've had so many Orisha stories now, but I also just felt like it didn't need like this whole like info dump about like who the Orisha are and what they are. Like it just fits seamlessly within the story.
Totally. Yeah, so like the Orisha, if you've read other things, then like Ogun would be familiar. You know, I remembering Ogun was the patron deity of, what do we read? The one with the Mamiwata.
Oh, Skin of the Sea?
Thank you. Skin of the Sea. The love interest there was like affiliated with,
yeah,
Ogun, I remember. So yeah, I love that you mentioned that, that it's just like, I appreciate that those are part of like our cultural milieu now at this point, you know?
For sure.
And on that point, there's like red caps, a wild hunt, mushroom fairy circles, glamours, deals and debts, like typical fairy shit also that was like important to the plot and was moving things forward.
Also, I just forgot about it till just right now when you were mentioning like the fairy circles, that there was one of the interludes, like I think the person was like dancing and then ended up in our time.
Whoa, I did not notice that. Cool.
Yeah, like they were like in London, but then there was like things that they didn't recognize there. So yeah, I kind of forgot about that part. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, the future books end up becoming into our contemporary time. I don't know if that's will be a thing or if this was just a way to like show the power of the fairies and like what they can do to you. But mm-hmm. I forgot about that part and I just found it really interesting. I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting this.
Oh, I didn't even notice that. Thank you for bringing it up. You mentioned at the in the summary that there's this like pact between fae and humans. Apparently it's like 2000 years old, and Ogun's ritual, it was necessary to kind of like kneecap the fae, for lack of a better word, you know, like to make them less powerful and to like bring the humans up from their lowly like non-magical status. But that's like Joan is trying it, is looking like she's set up to be the person who needs to like complete the ritual in order to,
yeah,
you know, return the balance, so to speak. We had possession, which I thought was kind of cool. I like to see how different authors take this like lack of agency slash increase in power. Like I like to see how they run with it.
Yeah, that part really reminded me of Legendborn. I guess more so Bloodmarked, but I was like, oh, what is this little possession thing we have going on in Black youth literature right now? I'm very interested to see if this is like something that we're going to see more often come up and why. So just things I think about.
Yes, zoom out. I love it. Getting into like the actual magic that we see on the page, we have Joan's metal bending. Shout out to all of you Avatar The Last Airbender fans who understand what that is. But she can like manipulate
people
metal.
People who are not fans know what that means too. Just
okay,
so you know.
I know. The new Avatar is coming out soon, so I'm excited about it. But I thought this was fun. The passages where it's describing like how the metal like speaks to her and the different metal, and she gives it like names and stuff. So it like almost is personifying these inanimate objects, which I thought was cool. And yeah, how we kind of have like a semi-closed magical system to where like people who like practice Orisha traditions and magic, it seems like they have to be more subtle, I guess, or secretive about their magic, mm-hmm. probably for like racism reasons.
Yeah. Well, and like witchy reasons, because that guy whose name I don't remember is like, you're a witch, you know.
It's witch hunt season, literally.
I don't know when that happened.
This is the 1600s, right? So
I think so.
That's witch hunt time.
Maleficarum or whatever. Is that the hammer of the witches? I took a whole class on it. It was very interesting.
That's really cool.
So this is both a world building and magically related, but Joan's whole family has different blessings from Orisha. Both of her parents are alive and well, which is so rare in YA fantasy.
We love to see it.
Yeah. And like she has like reasonable parents who seem nice and loving and care about her, which also is not always the case in YA, but maybe actually more often we do see this with Black YA.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe it's the white parents that are shit.
Like parents that actually listen to her and care about her opinions and her safety.
Yeah, like weird. And Joan is a twin, which like we also saw in Skin of the Sea as being something that's like very special. within, I don't know what you would call like the belief in the Orisha. But anyways, there's something special about twins. So I'm interested to see where this might be taken in future books. Because I was like, oh, very interesting twin things.
Yes.
Now we're going to talk about Conflict Villain and Good versus Evil and Get Me Kylo Ren.
I would say our villains are, it's our main dude that we can't remember the name of. He's the guy who works for King James. He's like the enforcer person or whatever. Yeah. And so I would say like powerful white dudes who you can't say no to because of like the structures that are in place. Like Joan's really in this like rock and a hard place situation where she can't like, if she says no to him, he has her burned at the stake for a witch or whatever. And then if she says yes to him, then she's like closer in proximity, so like more danger maybe. And yeah, it's never a good sign if you can't say no to someone. That's bad.
And it's wild too, because Joan literally saved his son's life and then he's like, you have to come work for me. Like, I was like, bro, you better hope she doesn't murder your ass. Like, this is not gonna go well for you.
She probably will later. I think we're setting
she
it
probably
up.
Will fingers crossed.
Something that just stuck out to me, just like the grotesqueness of whiteness and how like, just kind of like disgusting it is. Like I had this feeling of like repulsion, especially in the court scene where Joan is being, you know, treated like a dog or like even worse than probably they treat their dogs at court. You know what I mean? And it was very illuminating the power differentials and just how like whiteness tries to, or like really wants to separate itself, and like the obsession with like purity. And there was just like cruelty and ignorance everywhere, but that scene at court was like especially egregious. And I thought that the Brittany and Williams just did a really good job of, you know, not holding back and just showing like how cruel and how, you know, violent when you have a commitment to white supremacy than all of your actions are and how you treat other people. I thought that was, yeah, a really important part of the book
for sure.
All right, onward, magical friends. Let's walk into Mordor and read fantasy, and we'll talk about representations of race and class and gender and ability. So I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you know, women at this time in England were not allowed to work as actors. And yeah, it's just interesting to think that this wasn't the case everywhere in Europe, but we do kind of, especially in, I feel like, the US, that like British Isles kind of gets like the most airtime maybe.
Mm-hmm.
About like culturally at this time. Yeah, that just wasn't the case everywhere. There were famous actors who, you know, weren't dudes in other places in the world. I think it was Joan's brother who was doing a lot of the women roles. So it's kind of, yeah, interesting to see like the behind the scenes and the costumes and the makeup and everything that goes into like making gender appear, you know, on stage. This kind of like relates to the point I made back in Kylo Ren, but like I would say we really see represented like white people and how they're so ignorant and about / feel entitled to black body minds. The main example that's sticking out to me is Joan's hair. And was this Burbage who was talking about Joan's hair or like petting it or something? Maybe it was someone else. Oh,
it was like someone from the Queen's court. Like when she's up there, they're like touching her hair and like playing with it and stuff. Cause they're like, oh, I thought it would be softer or like more coarse. Cause she has very soft hair.
Mm-hmm. But there was also this moment where like Joan's hair got like super tangled, and then she came back to like the actor room or wherever, and everyone's like, the white people were like befuddled by it, you know? Yeah. They just have like no idea what's going on.
Yeah. And while we're talking about hair, I think this is a good time to talk about descriptions of Joan's hair. She wears different hairstyles throughout the story, like in braids, it's out, like protective hairstyles. I believe, if I remember correctly, she even sleeps with a bonnet. But I really like this line where Joan's hair is described as waist length when it's stretched out. There's like just so much misinformation about black women in particular and about how they aren't able to grow hair that's long. But non-black people never account for like shrinkage, which is real. Like even me, who does not, like I have, you know, 3BC hair instead of like more coily hair. And like my hair is probably 6 inches longer when it's stretched out than when it's curly. And it's the shrinkage is even more when you have like type 4 hair. So I really appreciated these descriptions and like the author writing, like Joan's hair is very soft. Like she wears these different styles. And I just think that's sometimes not something we see focused on. But I think even like here in our time, 2024, like there's just a lot of misinformation and disinformation about black hair. So I just appreciated this aspect. I think Nick is being coded as indigenous. I feel like really? There'll be more about this in the future, perhaps, but he is described as having like very different undertones for his skin than Joan. And he has like very long, excuse me, he has very long straight black hair. So I'm interested to see where this goes, or I could be completely wrong, but he's definitely not white. And I'm interested to see like what happens here.
Nick is the love interest, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. It's been a little while since I listened to this, so that's good. Good. Thank you for refreshing.
And then we have Shakespeare, who is white passing in this story. There's an author's note at the end that says like there's no evidence for this whatsoever. But I just thought that was an interesting thing to like change about the story. I don't know how I feel about it, but it was interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious if this will become more salient in future books. Like, yeah, because that passing privilege and yeah, that's curious. And I mean, like, not like we can retcon this historically, but like people were, you know, probably hiding things about their backgrounds or passing as things that maybe not just fully disclosing everything about themselves at the time, right? Just because of how, I don't know, limited in perspective and like because of like what's the word I'm looking for? Discrimination and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to think about like, yeah, there are characters in history that we don't know that like we'll never know everything about, you know, people back in the day. So it's interesting to think about, you know, maybe. Why not? It's a historical fantasy moment, so why not like make Shakespeare like race bent? That's kind of cool.
Finally, it's time for Shipwrecked, a segment about sexuality, asexuality, sex, romance, and relationships. And sometimes we take liberties and do some shipping of our own.
I got so excited in this moment where I'm pretty sure like Joan's parents were flirting with Robin Goodfellow. And I'm like, is there about to be poly parenting in the mix? Like, I'm so curious. I'm like, oh, what's going on? I'm here for it. Let's do it.
Yeah, it wasn't just you because I thought the same thing. And I was like, are we going to see parents with an open relationship? You know, hashtag clutches pearls. But I was just like, huh, this is interesting. Haven't seen this before. I'm interested. And Joan wasn't like weird about it too. So it makes me think like, what are her parents like in times when, like, you know, before this story is taking place? I was just like, huh.
Yeah. And it's kind of a segue to my next point that like there's bisexual and queer desire and maybe like Joan's seeing it modeled. And that's why she's not like,
yeah,
internalized the same like shame and self-loathing that sometimes like queer people can like pick up from our environment. But like Joan, for sure, bisexual, queer desire of multiple, you know, people she's interested in, and potentially her brother also. It seems like she's not interested in her brother. Her brother might be queer. Let me just clarify.
Yeah.
I like when like the queerness isn't the drama.
Yeah.
You know, like a love triangle's fun. You know, yeah. We love a dramatic love triangle. That's cool. Yeah. But it wasn't like that wasn't the sticking point. The fact that you have queer desires was not the sticking point, which I always appreciate.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because like Nick and Joan, like, I don't know if they're endgame or whatever, or Joan and Rose, but even Rose was kind of like, you could have us both. So like opening, like leaving an opening for that to be the case rather than having Joan, a 16-year-old child, decide who she wants to spend the rest of her life with at 16 years old. I mean, I know it was a different time, like you got married much earlier because you didn't live as long, but still, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah, like we're transcending the either or, why not a both and sort of thing, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, Kill Your Darlings. Let's talk about writing style, narration, characterization, plot structure, and whatever else we feel like. So there's definitely like a play within a play or a play within a novel moment, which is like a very Shakespearean move in general, which I thought was fun. I'm just curious, what was your experience with the Bard? Did you read any in high school? Did you have you seen like a play put on, a Shakespearean play put on? Like, I don't think we've really, this hasn't come up for us, but it's kind of fun to talk about.
Yeah, we don't talk about it very often, but it's funny because I read Shakespeare in high school, but actually I think the first one I read was in middle school. I've probably seen Hamlet no less than 3 times, and I've seen the complete works of Shakespeare abridged, which is like a very funny play acted out by like 3 actors, and it's like goes through all of his works like really quickly. It was so funny. And I think there's a replica of the Globe Theater about an hour from where I went to college, and I went there for like a class.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
I know Shakespeare gets like a bad rap, but I really like his plays. I love the adaptations. 10 Things I Hate About You, probably one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh my God. Heath like, Ledger.
Yeah, it's so good. And I love like Chloe Lise is doing like a retelling of the Shakespeare plays, but with like disabled and neurodivergent characters and like romance novels. And I have a book on my TBR about teaching race through Shakespeare, which I'm really excited to read, called The Great White Bard, How to Love Shakespeare While Talking About Race, because I think it could be really relevant for like teaching things that are like so core to what we teach in the US, but like how do we talk about topics that maybe like when we have a required reading list that we can't divert from, how do we still talk about things that are important and applicable today?
Right.
But yeah, I love Shakespeare. I don't know. Yeah, just love it.
Nice.
What about you?
I also love it. I think I read, maybe it was Midsummer Night's Dream in middle school, but I definitely read a lot of Shakespeare in high school. It was a big part of like the AP English syllabi, I guess, curricula. That's the word I'm looking for. And then I took a Shakespeare for non-majors class in college, which like you're reading like multiple plays a week. So I was like working through works that I'd never read before. Like I'd never read Macbeth before college or anything like that. I love the like iambic pentameter, the poetry of it. Yeah, it's almost like getting comfortable with another language too, because it's so different. The syntax and the vocab and stuff. It's really cool. Yeah, I just think it's fun. I'm into a remake. I feel like there were probably other playwrights that are also very interesting that aren't seeing the light of day, which is unfortunate because Shakespeare kind of has a monopoly on our like imagination of theater, especially at that time. But oh my God, agree with you. 10 Things I Hate About You. And you mentioned The Knight's Tale. It's like Heath Ledger. He was like my primo celebrity crush back in the day. Oh my gosh. I remember where I was in my high school when I found out he died. Like I can remember that moment. And yeah, I know, right? I'm dating myself for sure.
Yeah, because I was not in high school at the time. But
I'm just like a smidge younger. So yeah, I agree with you that it can get a bad rep. And that's cool that this book exists about like how to love Shakespeare while talking about race, because there's so much relevant stuff there. And like, you know, and class, right? Because race and class are all also always connected. And yeah, I'm sure that'll be a good read.
Yeah, I'm excited. There was also like a movie called Oh, which was a remake of Othello when I was a kid with Julia Stiles in it. And the guy from House, who like I hadn't seen him in much at the time, so now I don't remember his name. A black actor, he was playing Othello. But like that's a remake. Like for me, I think like the Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann one, like solidified my childhood crush on Leonardo DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. It was the 90s was like, oh, now I'm dating myself. But like the 90s had like an early 2000s had a lot of stuff that was just based on Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
That it was like unavoidable, even if you weren't like older reading those things in like high school and college or middle school. Yeah, there were a lot of remakes at that time. I kind of forget about it. The Lion King, that's Hamlet.
That's just Hamlet. Yeah. A lot of like cishet,
yeah,
primarily white remakes, but I'm glad that like this new, you know, wave that we're seeing is not that. It's like taking it even further, which I think will make Shakespeare be even more interesting then.
Yeah.
This is like a small thing, but like Joan did a lot of quote locking her knees to stay upright, unquote, which worked out for her, and I'm really glad. But like IRL, that can be kind of a quick way to pass out. So just a little note.
Yeah, as someone who's passed out a few times, don't do that.
I have not passed out, but I know, you know, from the, like, I was in this wedding once, and the person who was officiating was like, don't lock your knees. And he said it like so many times that I feel like it's been ingrained into my brain. And I was kind of like waiting for someone to walk their knees and pass out in the July heat, but that didn't happen.
The Colorado July heat.
It was like 90 degrees. It was hot.
We also had third person POV, which is, seems to be in the minority in the YA that we read. So I was just kind of surprised by it and thrown off, but it worked really well, I think, especially because of those interludes that you talked about earlier, to not be switching back and forth. I think this was like the right move. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. It's already time for real talk. Can you believe it?
I know.
Here we are. I have a quote and you have a thing.
Yeah.
So I'll read. I'll start with my quote. Mm-hmm. This is at 7 hours, 6 minutes, 58 seconds. I'm pretty sure it's into the book, not left, but maybe. I'm pretty sure I did that right. And this is talking about the ye old white guy who we forget his name, the crony for King James or whatever. His faith seemed more strategic than true belief, and such weak sentiments rarely held power. I just was like, ooh, yes. Christians called out. OMG. Yeah, especially just like people that are in it for the power and the money rather than actual belief. Although I was listening to a podcast called The Anti-Trans Hate Machine, A Plot Against Equality, and they talk about how like Christian nationalism is, you know, a big force behind all the anti-trans stuff that's going on right now. Highly recommend. It's by Imara Jones. I'll put a note in here so I don't forget to put it in our show notes. So yes, there is like strategic faith rather than true belief. And at the same time, there are like super powerful actors that like, they use like, I'd never heard people talking about like kingdom stuff. I'd never heard that like people talking about kingdoms here and kingdoms there and how you have to like prepare the ground for our apocalypse to happen and then everyone else will die except all the Christians or whatever that are going to ascend. But yeah, I was just thought that this book was, yeah, very poignant on this point about like there are certain people who are in it for the power and not necessarily because they, you know, actually are true to the tenets of Christianity or whatever, which would be like, I don't know, hanging out with all of the people in the street economy and not having any money and curing the sick and all this stuff. So yeah, Jesus was a pretty, seemed like a kind of a rad dude.
Yeah. I guess I'll take this religious talk one step further.
Please do. Please.
There was like this kind of general idea of like the loss and then the return of God/gods. And I think we see this a lot in books written by Black authors, like fantasy books. And I think this has a lot to do with a loss of faith folks might have encountering everyday/systemic racism, which I find super interesting. There was a new Pew research study about the rise of like the religious nuns. So people who with no specific religious affiliation, and it's mostly white men, but alternatively BIPOC are often more religious and more religiously affiliated. And this was super interesting to me that a belief in an all-knowing, all-loving God seems like difficult to accept when so many atrocities are committed against us, like BIPOC in particular, especially those that have been like committed in the name of God/gods. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written about this before, I think, in Between the World and Me, which might be like my first encounter with a Black atheist. I'm not saying people should give up their religion or anything of course, but like this was just like really fascinating to me to see how often it comes up as like religion as like a comfort for people going through hard times. And for me, that's kind of hard to justify. But either way, I just thought it was really interesting that I feel like we see this like again and again in fantasy written by Black authors in particular. So I'd be interested to like sit down with some of these authors and just like ask them some like questions about this and like their beliefs and stuff. But, you know, to each their own. I just find it really interesting and surprising.
Mm-hmm. Do you like distinguish between maybe like spiritual versus religious? Because like religious feels more like institutional to me. And maybe that's just wrong. Maybe it's like a square rectangle stuff. But like when I hear religion, it's like, yeah, like an institution like the Catholic Church or something, or like an Abrahamic religion or something like that. Maybe it's just like a non-distinction that I'm, you know, maybe I'm completely off the mark. I don't know. That's what kind of came up for me.
Yeah. And to me, like, the difference between like, I feel like often when I hear people be like, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, it's like almost always white people. So I think that's like a distinction that like white people make versus like BIPOC folks. And that could be completely wrong. That's just been my experience. Because to me, like spirituality, I mean, like in my mind makes me feel like that there's a belief in a higher power, which to me is just religion. So yeah, I don't know.
Fair enough. Cool.
Yeah. My own thoughts. I didn't look up any definitions for these words.
Neither did I. All right. Card questions.
Card questions.
Did the author get any details wrong? I wouldn't know.
I mean, I guess technically some of the stuff about like Shakespeare and the company are not true, but I don't think they got them wrong. They decided to change them.
That's on purpose.
Yeah, it was purposeful.
What main symbol is most prevalent and revealing?
The theater.
That's what I was thinking too. Yep. Mm-hmm. Almost as like a... as a way, as like an educational tool too, because like the literacy level is way different. Access to like education and information is so different there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like having moral lessons too, like given to the people. And it's very connected to, you know, powerful institutions like royalty and the court and the state. So yeah, I think that that's the main thing at work. I don't know if it's a symbol.
Yeah, but I feel like media more generally, like whether that be books, plays, TV, movie, like I do feel like it often like holds up a mirror to society. Like these are the things that we're believing at the specific point in time. And so like for us, the reader, for this book, the theater is like a symbol of like, this is like a symbol of society at that time. Like women weren't allowed to be in plays. Like they didn't treat Black people well. Like, you know, poor people had to like be in the area of the theater with no seats while like the, you know, royalty looked on from above, you know? So I think it just is kind of like a symbol of the society and how that worked at the time.
Boom. Beautifully said. Does this book inquire about, I would say it's a, the question says what it means to be quote male or female, which like, what is this book inquiring about gender? I guess I would rephrase the question.
I mean, gender roles for sure. Thinking about even just like the plays, you know, like who was allowed to be a performer.
Yeah, I think it's like we can't take the race aspect out of it too. You know, what does it mean to be a Black woman in Shakespearean England, right? Very different than what it means to be a white woman in Shakespearean England too. So I think that's
for sure.
That's top of mind for sure.
Thanks for listening to The Library Coven. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of The Wicked Bargain by Gabe Cole Novoa.
Yes, yeah.
I haven't started listening yet, so it'll be better next week. As always, we'd love to be in conversation with you magical folks. Let us know what you think of the episode, anything we missed, or just say hi by dropping a line in the comments or by reaching out to us on Instagram at The Library Coven.
And you all know that you can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and then the episodes will automatically drop in your feed. And if you have a few seconds or minutes to rate and review the show, we would really appreciate it. Or alternatively, you can just let someone know that there was an episode that you liked and share it with them. If you are able to support our labor financially, you can make a donation one time to us on Ko-fi. Ko-fi? I don't know how you pronounce it. It's been 5 years, but I still don't know.
Coffee. Like coffee. A cup of coffee.
Okay, thanks. And then you can also support us monthly on Patreon. We have a pay what you can for as little as $1 a month, or by shopping at our bookshop.org affiliate page. Until next time, stay magical.